Hello and welcome to another edition of Digital Flotsam. I'm P.W. Fenton. I'll bet you've never heard of Stendhal syndrome. I know that when I fell victim to it, I had never heard of it. But I hope, by the end of this program, you'll have a pretty good idea of what it's all about. In late May of 1991, I had the marvelous good fortune of having fathered a daughter who grew up interested in the Italian half of her heritage. She decided to study the Italian language, and while in graduate school, finagled herself the opportunity to study and teach for about 2 years in Florence, Italy, one of the artistic centers of the known universe. This in turn made it possible for her parents, a very small group of people that included me, and her younger sister Billy, to visit Italy, with the way cool advantage of being guided by a near native. Her Italian was so perfect, Italians often could not detect that she was an American, and so, to the Italians we met, we appeared to at least be the friends of a real local. Well, on the day it happened, I knew nothing about Stendhal or his syndrome. The day started with a visit to the Basilica di San Lorenzo. This is one of Florence's unfinished churches. In fact, when viewed from the street we were staying on, it almost looked derelict. It was just a featureless, unfinished building, sort of shaped like a church. On the opposite side, actually the back, it looked much more like a typical church. Inside the southern part of the basilica, there is a chamber called the New Sacristy. New, because the main part of the church was built in the year 393, and this new part of the building was designed and built by Michelangelo for the Medici family in 1520. Like many things started by the great Michelangelo, it remains unfinished. However, the tombs and sculptures it contains that were completed are incredible masterpieces. The Medicis were rich folks. They were the kind of people who made it possible for folks like Michelangelo to exist. They were the kind of people who simply paid artists to make art. Often their goal was to, of course, glorify themselves, but more often than that, their philanthropy simply allowed art to exist. After looking at these magnificent sculptures for a good while, I took refuge on a small bench in an unfinished area behind the tiny altar there. My back was aching and I needed to sit down for a bit. I sat there for a few minutes and began to notice the walls around me appeared to be covered in plexiglass. That seemed very odd. They were very ordinary looking rough plaster walls, nothing worth that sort of protection. But it made me curious about what this was all about, so I got up off the bench and looked more closely at the walls behind the altar. They were not ordinary plaster walls at all. They were covered with faint pencil drawings. How odd that seemed. I started to examine them in more detail. As I began to realize what it was I was looking at, the fine hairs on the back of my neck began to stand up, and I felt a little shiver go through my body. I was actually looking at faint pencil drawings of the things I had just been looking at on the other side of the altar. I was standing where Michelangelo stood 5 centuries earlier, sketching out his plans for the very room I was standing in. It was breathtaking. You could even see little holes in the plaster where he had poked a pivot point in order to draw a perfect arc. But my day had just begun. There were many hours ahead of walking with my wife Roz, my daughters Kim and Billy, through the cradle of the Renaissance, staring in awe of famous art treasures and architectural wonders. The Duomo, Brunelleschi's Dome, Michelangelo's giant marble statue of David, the treasures of the Uffizi. Every sight was more beautiful than the last. Our outing was almost over. There was one more church my daughter wanted us to see, Santa Croce. As we approached Santa Croce, it had a very striking facade, white marble elaborately trimmed with dark green marble. But the day was wearing on, and I was feeling like this was going to be the proverbial church that broke the tourist's back. I was toast. On top of that, my daughter Kim hadn't really told us much about this place other than there's one more place I want you to see. As we walked through its doors, I was expecting to see something very similar to all the other churches I had been in that day. Arches, columns, frescoes, statues, chapels, candles, paintings, crosses, altars, and so on. Instantly, the place felt really different. First, it looked different. It had a nave and two aisles like other Gothic cathedrals. A nave, by the way, is what they call the large open space down the center. But the thing that stood out was the fact that across the top of the nave were huge wooden beams and trusses, all brightly painted with geometric patterns. Also the floor. The floor was an amazing, haphazard, crazy quilt of different stone slabs. Many with inscriptions, some with inlaid pictures, some with worn-away relief sculptures, made of different kinds of stone, in different colors, all of them not really matching their neighbor. The fact that they were made of different types of material, and had been part of the floor for different lengths of time, made the floor wear unevenly, giving the floor a sort of smooth, polished, but uneven surface. These stone slabs, Kim explained, were all grave markers. It seems that since the church was completed in 1385, anyone with any wealth or influence campaigned heartily to be buried in this church. The floor was a who's who of Tuscan and Italian society. Roz, Kim, and Billy all started heading towards the other end of the church. Because my back was still bothering me, causing me to walk slower than them, and because I found the whole idea of the floor being covered with graves that people walk over every day fascinating, we became separated. I probably eventually looked at most of the things that they did, but I just did it at a different pace, and so, when it happened to me, I was alone.
Taking pictures of whatever's pretty, like the rivers, or a palace, or an artist with his palettes. He's painting pictures of the rivers, or a palace in the distance, where the queen is eating crumpets as the king listens to the trumpets. I'm just a tourist here. Building in Minnesota where a woman has a file on my goings and arrivals, and she loves me, or I hope so, 'cause otherwise I'm alone here, and that's no fun, especially when you're on the run. And so depression, a confession, is a constant battle when you're in Seattle, only waiting in your hotel for the future that you're hating. Oh, I just wanna go home, 'cause I miss my love and I'm tired of being alone. Oh, I just wanna go back
Yeah, so as I said, when it happened to me, I was alone. I say it happened to me because I'm still not sure what it was or how to put it into words. At some point in my wandering around by myself, I started paying more attention to the more elaborate tombs that were built into the wall of the main part of the church. Each one different, each one seemingly designed to compete with its neighbor. Some had enormous elaborate stone coffins, some had beautifully carved statues, some had frescoes, all had inscriptions. All were tributes to very famous people, and all were designed by equally famous artists. As I walked around the entire outer wall of the church, I began to feel a certain kind of awe, a certain kind of reverence for this place. Most cathedrals are designed to create awe and reverence, but usually it's the kind of awe and reverence that makes you feel tiny, in awe of the God you're there to worship. This was completely different. This was gathering up an overwhelming reverence for the accomplishments of humankind. Artists, scientists, philosophers, writers, musicians, all the people that are conduits for that hidden magic that the rest of us can only appreciate but not create ourselves. As I walked around these walls, I was passing the final resting places of giants. I was walking past names like Bruni, Rossini, Machiavelli, Enrico Fermi, Marconi, Da Vinci, Dante, Galileo. Galileo, the greatest scientific mind of his time, a man called a heretic by the Catholic Church because he had the gall to say that the earth revolved around the sun. A man who was not allowed a Christian burial in 1642 was finally laid to rest in this most holy place almost 100 years later. I was beginning to feel it. An indescribable awe. An indescribable sense of the power of beauty, the power of truth, the power of human aspiration. And I was beginning to feel overwhelmed by it. As dumb luck would have it, the last of these tombs I examined was back closer to the end where I started. I hadn't really taken a close look because a temporary wooden fence kept you out of that corner of the church. There was some scaffolding up in that area where some sort of repairs were being made, and it was dark and unlit. Still feeling this strong emotional upheaval, I walked over into this corner and pressed up against the wooden fence. It took a while for my eyes to adjust to the lower light level, but in a moment I could see it quite clearly. I could see that what I walked right by as I started my circuit was another elaborate stone tomb. The sarcophagus sat atop a blocky white marble platform. Sculptures of three female mourners sat on the edge of the platform. I later learned that the three figures represented painting, architecture, and sculpture. To me, they just looked beautiful and sad. On top of the sarcophagus sat a bust, presumably of the man inside. The man inside? Michelangelo. An artist that I personally find so brilliant and so talented that I sometimes get the feeling that he couldn't possibly be one of us, that he had to have come from somewhere else. The feeling just welled up inside of me, and I started to lose control. I felt myself trembling. I started to feel tears running down my cheeks. I started to hear footsteps. They sounded like they were coming towards me across the stone floor. I stood there, keeping my back towards the footsteps, hoping first that they didn't belong to anyone in my family, and second, thinking that if they did, that they wouldn't notice me and I would have a minute or two that I thought I needed to regain control of myself. The footsteps got louder and louder, and then from a few feet away I heard my daughter Billy's voice. "Dad? Are you okay?" The words hit me in the back like a flaming arrow. Apparently, I was not succeeding in my effort to hide in plain sight. Apparently, my posture was giving me away. I tried to speak some kind of answer, but nothing came out. I just stood there, shaking and blubbering, tears pouring down my face and unable to speak. Within a minute, Roz and Kim were standing behind me also. Billy was explaining in hushed tones that Dad appears to be crying. Kim asks me a few questions. I don't remember what they were, but I do remember I could only shake my head yes or no in response. More hushed tones behind me. I hear the name Stendhal for the first time in my life as Kim tries to explain to her mother and her sister what she thinks is happening to her father. I am beginning to get very embarrassed, but that doesn't do anything to help me pull myself together. I am a complete basket case. More questions. They are beginning to talk to me in tones normally used for the extremely young or the extremely old. "Do you want to stand here a little longer?" I nod yes. We are all standing at the railing, staring in the direction of Michelangelo's tomb. Silence, broken only by my occasional sniffles and sobs. Another question. "Would you like to go outside and sit down somewhere?" I nod yes. We walk outside into the piazza. Tears are still pouring down my cheeks from behind my dark sunglasses. I am trying bravely to keep my lips from trembling as we walk a short distance to a bench. I sit down there with my younger daughter, Billy, as Roz and Kim start to wander around the square looking at shops and stuff. Billy is an endless stream of questions I can't form answers to. "What's making you cry? Is it a happy cry? Did you see something that made you cry? Was it Michelangelo?" Except for the times when I can shake my head as an answer, each question just sends a new stream of liquid from my eyes and my nose. I can't speak, and finally people just stop asking me questions. We walk back to our hotel rooms on the other side of town. By the time we reach the hotel, I have managed to get control of myself, but I still won't speak because I'm afraid that if I try to explain it at all, I'll just start again. I think everybody silently understood that. Now we have to flash 14 years into the future. I'm getting ready to put this show together. I want to be as accurate as possible about these 14-year-old memories, so I start doing some research. I am particularly interested in finding out some information about Stendhal, because I know so very little about him. I was under the impression that because this syndrome was named after him, he had identified it in some way. I thought perhaps he was a philosopher or an anthropologist or maybe a physician of some kind. Turns out I was wrong. He was a French writer, and he didn't identify the syndrome. He experienced it and wrote about the effect it had on him. Other psychiatric types, years later, identified it as a syndrome and named it after him because he seemed to have been the first to write a good account of it. What came next is what blew me away completely. At this point, I figured that he had described some experience similar to my own. But that, too, turned out to be wrong. He didn't describe an experience similar to mine. He described an experience exactly the same as mine. Only difference? His occurred in 1817, while mine occurred in 1991. Otherwise, exact same place, exact same experience. These are the words I read. In 1817, a young Frenchman, known to us as the French novelist Stendhal, visited Florence, and soon found himself overwhelmed by the city's intensely rich legacy of art and history. When he visited Santa Croce, the cathedral where the likes of Machiavelli, Michelangelo, and Galileo are buried, and saw Giotto's famous ceiling frescoes for the first time, he was overcome with emotion. Then there's a quote from Stendhal himself. "I was in a sort of ecstasy from the idea of being in Florence, close to the great men whose tombs I had seen. Absorbed in the contemplation of sublime beauty, I reached the point where one encounters celestial sensations. Everything spoke so vividly to my soul. I had palpitations of the heart, what in Berlin they call nerves. Life was drained from me. I walked with the fear of falling." You said it, my brother. 174 years later, I walked in your exact footsteps and reached that same point of celestial sensations, and I too walked with the fear of falling. And there you have it, another edition of Digital Flotsam. I'm P.W. Fenton. Be sure to check out the show notes at digitalflotsam.org.
And P.W. holded the microphone.